So I said, what's going on? This is the first takeover.
Right.
And they said, we want to discuss what we can do to stop this terrible thing that's going on over there. And I said, okay. And so I said, you got to let me in my office so I can call some people. So I called the president, and the president came right in. And he and I talked with them, which started what I would say was about 3 days of negotiation, students, faculty, and administration. And during that time, no one held classes. Now, that was takeover one.
Mm-hmm.
Takeover two was a totally African-American related takeover. The African-American students, of which we had many more then than we have now. We have a much more diverse student body now in terms of ethnic groups, but we had a lot more black students then. We had 73 in about 1971. And they were all American, African American students, except maybe one or two from Africa. once again, I came to work, tried to get in the library, and the doors were chained shut. So I said to these people, what do you want? And they said, we have a list of 10 unnegotiable demands. And I said, okay, I better get the president. So I called the president, he came in. That led to a week of negotiation with the black students about their 10 demands that became 11 demands. the 11th was that there wouldn't be any reprisals for the 10. and so we negotiated. I thought it was a very successful thing for the black students. Because I would say within 2 years, or maybe 2.5 years, all 10 things that they had asked for, the college had at least started to make moves in that direction. those directions. That was when the Black Cultural Center was in terrible shape and it needed to be renovated and cleaned up, and the college hadn't put much into it when they first made it available. That was one of the early things. A black student library, a section of the library with books for black students, etc. Now that was takeover two. Takeover three, I was in my office one night. This two and three were in 1971. The other one was in 1970. Number three, I was in my office, and one of the librarians came down and said, Mr. Walker, the black students have taken over. There was a room on the second level that was called the 20th Century Room. And it was initially designed when the library was built to hold the leading books of the 20th century that had been published in the 20th century. And the librarian said, there are a number of black students being led by a black faculty member who are going through the library. They have a bibliography, and they're pulling off all the books of the regular shelves downstairs, pulling off all the books that they have listed in their bibliography that relate to blackness. And they're taking them up to the 20th Century Room because there was a lot of shelf space there. They had built the room so that as the 20th century progressed, it would fill up with more new books. So the students were taking these books, putting them on the shelves up there. actually, to show us that they were demanding, that was one thing that we hadn't done yet from 1970, a separate portion of the library for books involving blackness. That was number three. That took the chair of the faculty and I, that was Monday, We started negotiating with the black students at 9 on Monday morning, and we would break for meals. I'm not sure we broke for dinner every night, but lunch. We would break for meals and go until about 8 at night, 7:30 or 8 at night, until Friday. On Friday, we came to an agreement with the black students that we would do these things. And so there was no point in negotiating any further. And I'm sure the kids who were here at that time didn't think we were moving fast enough. But it's not easy to move very fast to clear off a space in the library and things like that, and to get construction going in the Black Cultural Center. And I can't remember what the 10 demands were. I can remember 3 or 4 or 5 of them. More black students, more black faculty, more black administrators. Those were among the demands. I don't know whether that was one demand or 2 or 3. But those were the 3 takeovers. Now, one of them was not at all related to the other two. The other two were kind of a piece.
So when you were in negotiations for the second and third one, did the students stay in the library the whole time that you were negotiating?
Yeah. Well, no, they didn't take over the library. The black students only blocked the door. And then when we started negotiating with them, we all went back to a normal schedule of going back home and sleeping and going to the rooms and sleeping, and they had breakfast and came in, and then they would have lunch and we'd take a break at lunch. And probably most of the nights we had dinner too, went home to dinner and came back. The first one that was not the African American related one, the library was taken over. Yes, but when we started discussing an open faculty meeting with students present, not all students, but a few present, Student Government Association people and some people from the SMB and things like that, so they could take pictures. then the black, then the takeover students, not the black students, but the the people who were opposed to the war, as all of us were, then left, and we all started talking about what we were going to do about this. And that outcome, what happened first was, there was a mass meeting of students and faculty on Central Campus, and we decided we would send a delegation to Washington. Because one of the trustees was a speechwriter for Nixon, and he could get us into the president's cabinet. And so the president, another dean, and I, 2 faculty members, and 2 students and a townsperson flew to Washington. And we... This was after about a day and a half of community-wide discussion. Because as administrators, we didn't know what the devil to do. The faculty didn't know what to do. The students didn't know what to do. And so we just had this attempt at meeting of the minds about how to go about objecting to what was going on in Washington and in Vietnam. And so we got the 3, 5, 7, 8, the 8 of us got to Washington about 6:30 the first night we were out. Now on the way, it gets even more complicated because 250 students were going to the governor's office to demand that the governor not go to Iowa City. See, it was graduation time in most of these colleges around here. And the students wanted to go to the governor's office to demand that the governor not go to the University of Iowa and present the commissions for the ROTC, which he always had before in the past. And so here we are. They got some students from Simpson and some from Drake. And I would assume in the State House, the governor's office probably was able to hold about 50 on the floor, but then they opened the doors. They were big doors. And there were probably another 250 out in the, if you've ever, you haven't been in the Iowa State House probably, but there's a giant central area there. And so before I took off to go to Washington with the president and the rest of the group, the president called me in and said, you got to go with these students and make sure they don't try to disrupt the governor's office. And I thought, oh my God, how can I stop 250 Grinnell students? But I knew a lot of them, and we got along pretty well together, and they knew that we were going to be going to Washington to do whatever we could. And so one of the funnier elements of it, we all got in there and I sat down on the floor, but I was going to go on to the airport from the governor's office and take off and go to Washington, pick our guys up and go to Washington with them. And I was sitting on the floor, but I had a jacket and a tie and a white shirt on. And the governor came in and said, I had met him before here, and he said, don't I know you? And I said, yes, I'm Dean Walker from Grinnell, and I'm here as a representative with our students to ask you to not do this thing in Iowa City. And he said, well, get off the floor. And he said to one of his assistants, get Dean Walker a chair. And he put it right beside his desk. And so here's the governor and me sitting there talking with the students, and the students were excellent. They did not scream or anything like that. It was just a good conversation, making some demands, of course. Then the president, I met the president at the airport and the party that went to Washington, and we got in that night, and the next morning we started at 7:30, and we saw 6 members of the president's cabinet, I believe it was 5 or 6, the Nixon's cabinet, and told them how we felt about these things. And then we spent the rest of the day going around talking to, we had an hour audience with the Secretary of State, and he was not in favor of Nixon's policy in Vietnam and Cambodia, of course. And so that was kind of funny because he really was delighted to have somebody to talk to, because he said, this is not my policy. I have nothing to do with the Nixon policy. So here are these 8 or 9 people coming in from Grinnell. And we were the first there, I believe. And so we had about an hour discussion with the Secretary of State, and we had to say, we have to go, sorry, Mr. Secretary, but we have to go because we have all these other people to see. And I think he was unhappy that we weren't there to talk with him. But then we went on and saw every one of the representatives from Iowa and every one of the 2 senators from Iowa. The 2 senators were, there was a Democrat and a Republican, just like today. And I would say that the majority of the people that we saw who were representatives were probably Republican, because Nixon had a majority at that time. Then we went back to the room that night and called back home to see what was going on, and the dissension was building and building, and the president of the Student Government Association was kind of holding the rest of the students at bay until we all got back. He ultimately became a very well-known attorney in Denver. He had been the legislative assistant after I graduated from college here to two senators. So he was a very well-known guy. He became a trustee of Grinnell College. He's dead now. He died about 4 years ago. His name was Lowy, Andrew Lowy, L-O-E-W-I, if you want to give him credit, because he did a great job of kind of keeping the students from just blowing up. Something that we were very concerned about at that time was students in other universities in the country were trashing the universities. And we had some construction going on here, and with big piles of bricks around, and as much glass as we have in the library, and as we had in the Fine Arts Center at the time, and some other buildings. What was happening in other places where students were picking up rocks and bricks and breaking windows. At the University of Wisconsin, a student bombed one of the science buildings there and killed a mathematics professor. He died from student disruption. And in fact, there was a type of architecture that was developed at that time called trash architecture. Because what they did like at any building that was built for the next 3 or 4 years at the University of Wisconsin had very narrow windows like that. So if the students decided they were going to trash something, it was pretty hard to trash that little window. But things settled down in the country. But we were really concerned because throughout the country, there was a lot of this dissension, and students were demonstrating in a much more wild fashion than ours were. They took over the ROTC building. About 2 days before the Cambodian thing, or 2 days before the Kent State thing. But then when all the student body and all the faculty and all the administration were so involved with what we were going to do, it took the focus of attention away from the ROTC building, and they left with a big sign on the blackboard that said, "We'll be back in September." They didn't. September. To tell you the truth, after this terrible time here, September was about the quietest September I ever put in 42 years at Grinnell College, because what happened was we offered the kids two options. You can take the grades you got now in these courses, because it was 10 days before commencement and finals hadn't come yet. You can take the grades you got now, or if you want to improve your stature in class, you can take an incomplete, and we'll give you until the 1st of October to complete it this coming fall. And I bet that 55% of the kids had at least one incomplete. I was teaching at the time in addition to being an administrator, and my classes for the fall I might as well not have held, because kids were working their fannies off trying to get these classes from last spring done. Some kids had three, so it was a tough go for them to be taking three or four courses and trying to finish up three courses. So there wasn't a lot of teaching going on or learning in the new classes. But it was, we came through it, and I think the place was much better for it. I was very surprised at one thing. We held a faculty meeting that went on, I suspect, for 6 hours maybe. Students were there, as I said before, and the S&B was there. And anybody that wanted to speak could speak, of course. And the faculty was just incensed at what had happened in Cambodia and what had happened in Kent State and what was going on in Vietnam. And the students were very upset. In the first place, they were upset because this was a terrible thing that was happening to human beings. But there was another thing back then that doesn't ever get our students today or since that time. demonstrating like that, the draft. Every one of our students was registered for the draft at that time. And many of them, when they graduated, it was possible, if you were in good academic standing, to be deferred until you graduated. But when you graduated, unless something else happened, unless you got married and had kids or something like that, you went to service. And I suspect several of them went over to Vietnam, which is a disruption in itself for the person that I happened to have been drafted for the Korean War, and I wasn't terribly happy about it. I didn't have to go to Korea. I stayed in this country, but I was in the service. But I think that that was a great piece of community learning that went on then. It was a wonderful... The thing that surprised me most was the faculty and administration took a vote in that long faculty meeting to censure the President of the United States in relationship to Cambodia, Vietnam, and Kent State. And what the outcome of that was, the President and I presented that to the trustees when they met in June after the place had closed, and there was a regular June meeting. And they said, in essence, don't give us that stuff about censuring the President of the United States. The faculty can't speak for the college. The administration can't speak for the college. The college is composed of students, faculty, alumni, trustees, administrators, and you've only sampled a couple of them, faculty and administration. And so don't give us that stuff about having censure of the President and the administration of the United States, because you can't speak for the college, because that's what we have said. The college censures. It wasn't the faculty of Grinnell College, it was Grinnell College. And so it never even was put into the trustees' minutes. I'll bet if you go back and look at the trustees' minutes from 1970 June, there was nothing said about the censorship of the President of the United States. I've had a lot of kids ask me about this time and these times, and some have even come and said, what do you do in a demonstration? What do students do when they're putting demands on the college? And my response to that is, well, there's no one at the present time who was in jeopardy that the students were in because of the draft. That's the one factor. And I'll tell you, I don't know what your political affiliation is, but please don't let me hurt your feelings. But that was the one smart thing that George W. Bush did. He didn't have a conscription. He did not have a draft of civilian personnel. If he'd had a draft of civilian personnel for this mess in Iraq, there'd have been Stuarts out in the street again throwing bricks at windows and things like that. Because that was what galvanized the students into doing this back in 1970. That plus the inhumanity towards man at that time. So there are the three, and I don't know which one you're focusing on for your production. Do you?
Originally, I think we were thinking of the second one, but I think we're interested in all of them.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I was wondering if you could speak to the impact of any of these takeovers on the other students that weren't involved in them, like if it affected campus culture.
Well, everybody was involved
in the first one,
except there was a handful of extremely conservative students. Politically conservative students. And it happened that two of them happened to be co-editors of the S&B. And they spoke out strongly against this. Several faculty members who were conservative politically also spoke out. There was a list of 14 faculty members that was presented to the administration saying, we did not vote for this, vote in favor of it, we voted against it, and we do not like what the college is doing. And actually, one faculty member and it ultimately became two faculty members that left because of that, and one administrator. We had an administrator who had been in the Marine Corps, and he was strongly in favor of the United States involvement in Vietnam, etc. And so they left, ultimately. The first one left right then. He resigned immediately. The other two waited a year until a job came up because it was a bad job market in June. but it was a really big thing at the college, you can imagine. But it was a really big thing at all colleges in the country. Now, I think Grinnell, Oberlin, Antioch, a number of Reed College in Oregon, a number of highly liberal schools were just as deeply involved in it as Grinnell, and some more so, like the University of Wisconsin, where there were bombings of buildings. it was something that tore the United States up. It wasn't just on campuses. It was a bad scene.
And with the second, too, with the black students' takeovers?
Well, I have to say that I think we had the majority of the students were sympathetic to the black student cause when they took over the library with their list of 10 unnegotiable demands. but they weren't participants in it like they were in this other thing. And I don't know where the rest of the student body came out in regard to the library. I have to say that I was a little bit embarrassed because I was the only administrative officer here when the students took over the 20th Century Room and were putting books up there. And I had just received, about a week before they took over the library, a notice from the U.S. government that said, any disruptions that you have on campus, because they were just getting around to reacting from the 1970 thing, any disruptions you have on campus, you have an obligation to take the students' names who are disruptive and we'll withdraw their student loans. Now, that's a pretty big club. And so when the librarian came down and said, Mr. Walker, the students are taking over the 20th Century Room, I went up and I would guess there were probably 44 or 5 black students there, many of whom are great friends of mine now. and I didn't know what to do. So I took this document with me and I read the document. And it was a little bit funny because I found out one thing. When you're scared and have a piece of paper like this, don't try to read it like that. What I had to do was put my foot up on a chair and lean the document on my knee like that so it wasn't shaking so badly that I couldn't read it. but I then said, okay. And there's a picture of that very thing in the S&B, by the way. Me standing up there with this damn piece of paper, because if I held it with one hand, it was going like that. And I said, okay, I'm going to go down in my office and smoke a cigarette, and I'm coming back here in 10 minutes. And anybody here, I'm going to have to take their names. Well, I got down to my office, and I thought, I know about half of those black students up there, but I don't know the rest of them. And our dean of students at the time was black. His name was Kimball. The Black Cultural Center is named after him. And he reported to me. And so I called him and said, it wasn't a good thing for me to do. In retrospect, it was a bad thing to do. I said, Connie, I don't know who the students are. I explained the situation to him. I need somebody that knows all the names. And he said, okay, boss, I'll do it. And I think it affected his effectiveness with the black students from then on. But when I went back up with Connie, because I needed to have somebody, there was not a student in the 20th century room, but they lined the stairway that went up. And Connie and I walked between these two rows of, as I say, there must have been 38 or 40 black students there. And we could hear them whispering negative comments about Connie as we passed up the stairs. They didn't mean, but I suppose they just thought, here's an administrator that's just trying to, and I'm not black, but Connie was black. And he was a big guy. He played tackle for the University of Indiana and was all Big Ten. And nobody argued with Connie. But it was that one. I suspect there were fewer student sympathizers for the takeover of the 20th century room than there were for the negotiation of the 10 things.
Wow.
Now, you're getting my point of view on this, but I was, in all three cases, with the black students, I was one of, in the first one, I was one of two negotiators, chair of faculty and me, and in the 20th century room, I was the only one. Now, in the other one, of course, everybody in the administration and the faculty and the college were deeply involved in that. You can't imagine what it is to wake up and turn on the news and hear that the National Guard has killed two students in Kent State. No wonder the students fell apart at that time. And there had just been a report that they were bombing Cambodia and they had bombed civilians. It wasn't just military activity. It was civilians were killed too.
Wow.
So, was there any result, like your visit to the Iowa State House?
I can't remember whether he went over and by that time the University of Iowa had blown up. I don't think they closed, but there were really stronger demonstrations at the University of Iowa than there were here. And I can't remember whether he went over and presented the commissions to the graduates of the ROTC. He was a good governor. I happen to be a Democrat. He was a Republican governor, but he's the only Republican I have ever voted for in the state of Iowa. And I voted for him every time because his name was Robert Ray. You may have heard of him before. He was on campus here quite a bit. and everybody respected him. And I would guess he did something that kept him from giving the commissions. Maybe they had a private commissioning ceremony or something, because the commissioning ceremony was always a big scene with parents and everybody there.
During the days of the negotiation, the second one with the 10 demands, were people allowed into the library or was it completely like shut down?
You mean when we were negotiating with the black students?
Yep.
Yep. The library went on. Okay. After the first hour, we said to the black students, look, we've got to let the kids use the library, so we'll take open the doors. And they were responsible bunch of kids.
Who was the, do you remember who the faculty member was in the third, in the 20th century room takeover?
Yes, I do. But you're asking a very old man to come up with some, remembering some name, and names are very hard. Yeah.
Maybe you can think of it later.
Gosh. It'll come to me sometime. If it does, I'll let you know.
Thank you.
It's kind of, there were some very funny things about all of these things. I wouldn't have you do these in the production, but when the other dean and I got to Washington, that first night we got there about 6:30 and ate a quick dinner, and Joe said, I think we need a bottle of booze. And I said, so do I. And so the biggest shock of that day was we were staying in the DuPont Plaza in Washington, and I just went to the phone and asked room service to deliver a bottle of Johnny Walker to our room, and they delivered it. And when Joe found out what the price was, I thought he was going to go through the ceiling, because see, that was in 1970, and dollars were a bottle of scotch, a fifth of scotch, not a liter, a fifth of scotch in the DuPont Plaza cost $45. Of course, that's room service and all that stuff that goes with it.
Wow.
That was one thing. Another thing, that in the black student negotiations, yes, I can tell you who the guy was. It came to me. His name was Virginius Thornton, and he was a professor of, he was an instructor, no, he was an assistant professor of African American Studies. He didn't stay very long, but he didn't get pushed out because he had done this. He did a pretty meticulous job of getting this bibliography around of all those, because there were a ton of library books that didn't necessarily, weren't focused on blackness, but had a chapter on something like that. And he had a very meticulous bibliography, because the kids were just going finding all these books throughout the library. He must have worked on it for quite a while before. other things. Is there still a CBS?
Mm-hmm.
The lead spokesperson for the CBS would always come to me with a tape recorder and a microphone, and he would never talk to me unless he had this microphone under my chin. And I had just interviewed a woman faculty member, a very fine black woman faculty member, and he came to me and shoved the microphone under my chin and said, Mr. Walker, have you had your confrontation with Carolyn Reed Wallace yet? And I said, Wash, I don't have confrontations with candidates. I'm trying to convince her to come here. I was just interviewing her, Wash. Oh, all right. And one time, about 5 years after he graduated, he was a pretty great guy. He happened to be a big football hero here, too. But somebody knocked on my door. My wife and I were going out. Somebody knocked on my door, and it was Wash and another guy that had been in the negotiations. And I said, hi, Wash, what can I do for you? He'd been in, lived in Pennsylvania or somewhere like that. He said, I got one unnegotiable demand. I said, what's that, Wash? He said, I want a 6-ounce glass with 5 ice cubes in it and 3 ounces of scotch. And then I want to talk with you. And so the three of us sat around it. I sent my wife to the dinner party. And the three of us sat around and talked. We had a great conversation for an hour and a half.
That's cool.
Unnegotiable demand.
When they moved all the books into the 20th century room, was that like a lot of work for the staff?
Yeah, to pick up? The library staff had to re-put them in the places where they belonged. But the library staff does that all the time anyway. I don't know how many books they had. They had several piles on the floor that were that high and then had filled in a number of the shelves that were vacant. And within, on that one, I would say within 3 or 4 weeks, there was a spot in the library that had nothing but Black-related books.
What happened to the 20th century room? Is it still there?
No.
Yeah.
The staircases go up from the ground floor, the first floor. And the 20th century room was right at the top in the middle of those two staircases. Mm-hmm. And it was glass. And it had some very fancy furniture that had been designed by world-class architects in it. And it was a classy place. And they picked a place that I suspect if they'd have pushed hard enough, we would probably have given them a chunk of the 20th century room. But we ended up setting up a bunch of shelves closer to the front door. They were interesting. The dealing with the Black students on these two, I enjoyed more than I did the other one because I didn't know what to do about it. You can't have a faculty or students or administrators. I didn't know what to do about the world problem of the war. I hated the war too. I hate this one. I don't know what I'd do now if I were threatened with a draft. We were very fortunate to have a volunteer military right now, because boy, you haven't ever seen anything that sets students on fire except during the Second World War. And there was enough of a holdover from that when I was drafted to go to Korea or go into the Korean War that there was still enough patriotism left. My biggest loss, folks, until I was about 35, was the fact that I was 3 years too young to get into the Second World War. Everybody wanted to be in it. You don't understand. It's hard for... I've tried to explain it to my children, who are now 50 and 47, and they don't understand that kind of patriotic feeling. And it's... Everybody's looking back at it right now. Veterans Day today, this is a big thing. And Iowa sending all these old World War II guys out to Washington to see the monuments and everything. It's interesting. Fortunately, I'd seen them all.
I guess this is like unrelated to the project, but just what do you think of the way that Grinnell's changed over the past like three decades?
Well, I think... First, in the 60s, there were a lot of things that contributed to what I call the students finding their voice. when I was I came here in 1958 as a biology professor. And in 1958, if I would have said the moon is made of green cheese, the students in my class would have nodded and said, "Yes, sir, Mr. Walker, you know. Yes, yes." But by 1970, students were criticizing the way their faculty members ran the classes, things like that. And I think the demonstrations were possible because students were finding their voices before the demonstration and during the demonstrations. I think things have calmed down quite a bit now. I think students right now are a little more like, not totally like, but a little more like the students of the early 60s. Pretty serious about getting out of college and getting a job and those kinds of things. And these students, many of them didn't give a damn whether school kept or not. We had students in 1970 who went to Canada to avoid the draft. And we had an awful lot of students that had psychiatric problems because of this. I'll tell you one more story. We had a clinical psychologist on campus who taught psychology half-time and counseled students half-time. And he left to go to a major university, and we hired another one, a guy who had a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Iowa. And this was his first job. And I thought he was great. I'd interviewed him. I thought he was great. And he was. But the Cuban Missile Crisis came on, which followed the Bay of Pigs and all of that business. And the Berlin Wall was being built at that time. Yesterday was the anniversary of the destruction of the Berlin Wall. But at that time, the Berlin Wall was being built. And the students were so upset by the Cambodian Missile Crisis. I don't know whether you've ever looked into it or not, but we found, not Cambodian, I'm sorry, Cuban Missile Crisis. We found, the government found, that the Russians were putting missiles in Cuba that could have hit this country very easily. And Cuba, of course, was a communist country. And the students were so upset by this that they started falling apart. And this clinical psychologist, who hadn't had a lot of experience, except clinical psychologists have to have a lot of clinical experience in analyzing, doing clinical psychological analysis, students started piling up on him. And he was counseling students probably 20 hours a day, and maybe teaching a course or two, too. And he went out to Rock Creek Lake and blew his head off. And I can remember the president calling the faculty together at that time and saying, as far as I'm concerned, Grinnell College is not going to have another member of its faculty who does clinical psychological counseling. And it was at that time that we joined into the Powashik County Mental Health Clinic. It was Powashik Jasper at that time, but it separated off, and it's now just Powashik. But we have had them do all of our clinical counseling, not a member of the faculty. It's interesting, the first guy who was a clinical psychologist had no trouble at all because he said, my office is open for clinical psychological counseling from 12:30 until 5:30, and never beyond that, and never before that. But when George came and all of this other stuff blew up, he started seeing kids before the morning classes and during lunch and at night and the middle of the night. It just was too much for him. Anything else, guys? Where are you from?
I'm from Minneapolis.
I'm from Washington, D.C.
I'm going to Minneapolis in 2 weeks. I have a granddaughter who graduated from the Air Force Academy 3 years ago. Yeah, you don't need to take